We're going to talk about principles for the toughest job, parenting. About 5 years ago, Grant and I had the opportunity to speak together at a Navigators, I think it was a business and professional conference. I was supposed to speak on parenting, and I thought, well, boy, what a great deal. I'll get Grant to share that with me. And so he did, and we had a great time with it. At the time, he was about a senior in college and not married. Well, where are you now, Grant?
Now we're celebrating our 4-year wedding anniversary in a couple weeks.
Not he and I, but...
We've got 2 kids. Got a little girl who's going to be 3 in March and a son who just turned 1. So today I'll tell from the perspective of the child at times versus the parent, and other times I'll tell from the perspective of the young married versus the grandparent. So,
not versus, but vis-a-vis.
That's right.
At times it's versus, but...
Most of the time it's...
Well, let's start off with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for every man here. We thank you for the family they've left back home. And Lord, you know the intimate details of each of our lives, and you know exactly what we need to hear. And so I pray that every word that is said here today, every thought that we think would honor you and would deliver the message you want. In Jesus' name, amen. What we want to do is just share with you, you know, we could give you, 1,000 principles for parenting and go on and on forever. What we did is we took the talk that we gave 5 years ago, and it's amazing how with our different positions in life, you know, then I was a dad, now I'm a granddad and still a dad. Then he was a young man becoming an adult but not married. Now he's been married several years and 2 children. Is that where we are right now, 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was looking
at airplanes the other day and looking at a 4-place airplane, and Grant said, well, Dad, that may not be enough.
Jury's still out. We'll find out soon.
Okay. And so we'll tell you what we have, and then we'll hopefully have some time at the end to share the collected wisdom of the group. 10 principles for parenting. The first one is show them the Father. You know, we see these little bracelets, what would Jesus do? And that has become kind of trite. I think that a lot of people wear those and don't really think what the bracelet is supposed to mean. But the facts are that our calling as parents is the same as Jesus' calling was when he came to the earth. You remember in John 14, one of the disciples said, show us the Father. And Jesus said, I've been with you this long and you don't know? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. The truth is, whether we like it or not, the way our kids think is whatever they see in us, that's what they believe about the Heavenly Father. If they see in us a Father who's kind, who's considerate, who has time for them, who has their best interest at heart, that's the way they believe God is. If they see in us a Father who has no time for them, a Father who's always running them down, a Father who's abusive, then that's the way they think God is. And so whatever picture we paint is the picture that our kids are going to start with as to how their Heavenly Father is. And so it's an awesome responsibility for us as an earthly father to realize that however we interact with our children, however we relate with our children, that's going to frame their picture of God the Father. Granny, comments on there? You want to go on to the next one?
Well, I think there's also another dimension to it. And as a new father trying to figure out how I should parent my children. You know, when Jesus was here, his life's purpose was just to show the Father. And so a lot of times when I'm wondering how to respond, with the knowledge that, you know, the way that I respond is going to impact the way that they view their Heavenly Father, a lot of times I look for my direction, I look for my example just from Christ. And that's, so show the Father, I mean, that works with an understanding of how the child will view God, but it also makes me look to God a lot, knowing what to do.
I was talking to some guys over at the lunch room after lunch, and one of them asked, what's the toughest thing that you face, the toughest decision you make? I'm mayor of Oklahoma City. I've spent 26 years in the business world, and I was in business with my 2 brothers. Kent is speaking tonight, but Kent and Craig, and so quite a bit of experience in the business world, but by far the toughest issues I've dealt with in my adult life have been issues related to parenting. Business is relatively easy. You either make money or you don't. You get the deal or you don't. Product works or it doesn't. But parenting is tough. In fact, parenting is relatively easy, I think, until they become teenagers. All of my children were relatively perfect until they became teenagers. Since then, and I have three pretty good kids. Grant's 27, married. Blair's a sophomore at OU, and then Annie's a sophomore in high school. We have three wonderful children. But in every one of those children's lives, we as their parents have had times when we really struggled. And really, in fact, didn't even know how to handle the situation we were dealing with. You know, sometimes you just don't know between you and your wife whether it's right to say yes or no to this situation. So what I do at that time is I say, okay, how does God treat us? And the truth is, God gives us quite a bit of freedom, doesn't he? God could have made us where we didn't have any choice, but he gave us free will. Now, some would argue about that, and I don't want to get into that discussion today. But God gives us free, and God even gives us the right, the power, to choose the wrong path. And so it's really hard to know when to say, okay, I don't like that, but go ahead, or when to say, no, we're not going to do that. And it's hard to know when to draw the line. So not only do we show them the Father, but we ask, what would Jesus do, or what would God do? How does God relate to us in a similar situation?
All right. Now, the second point, it says it takes time. You know, healthy parent-child relationship must be built on sincere communication, and there's no substitute for just time spent together. In Matthew 6:21, it says, "For where your treasure is, there shall your heart be also." And I think that you could kind of adapt that financial principle to say, "Where your time is spent, there shall your heart be also." And so, the most frustrated person is a person who has had some disconnect in his priorities. He says his priorities are with his family, and yet he can't find time, or he doesn't make the time to spend time with his families, and that's going to be a frustrated individual. In the Bible, there's examples of how parents can pour into their children. Deuteronomy 6:6-9 is where it talks about, so talk to them when you sit and when you get up, when you lay down and as you're walking down the street. Teach them my principles. Kind of a walk through life together mindset, you know, throughout the day. It doesn't have to be special times that you fit right into your calendar. It's just living life together. In Acts 20:31, Paul is talking about the relationship that he had with some of the people that he was discipling. And it says, "For 3 years I've never stopped warning you day and night with tears." 3 years, day and night, just pouring into them. In our family, at night, my 2-year-old, her name is Emma Grace, and she is blessed with a lot of energy and a strong personality. And it's a blessing. It's challenging at times, but we know that is a gift from God. Now, trying to put her down to bed is a challenge every night. And the thing that she'll say over and over, she'll say, "Daddy, tell me a story." And then I'll tell her a story, and she'll say, "Daddy, tell me another story." And I'm thinking, okay, she's stalling so she doesn't have to go to bed. But her way of saying, "Daddy, tell me a story," I think the thing that she loves so much about that is that she knows that my attention is focused completely on her. I'm not distracted with business. I'm not distracted with a ball game that's on TV. But I'm just pouring to her. And it's those subtle times that she will begin to realize that she's a priority in my life. And so it takes time.
One way this played out for us when our kids were young is to read to them when they're young. Particularly when they're preschool and in the early elementary grades when they can't read for themselves. And I'll tell you the truth, when Grant was little, we didn't read much to him when we put him to bed. In fact, our deal with Grant was put him in there, be quiet, shut the door, and then we just let him scream. And if he was screaming, we figured he was still alive and all was well. But with the two younger children, we got into the pattern of reading to them as we were putting them to bed, reading to them and praying with them. And particularly in Annie just, she still reads a lot. And I think a lot of that goes back to when she was a very small girl, reading to her. But it does take time. And a lot of parenting is just going through those rather routine things in life. You know, I've talked to lots of men, the ages we are in this room. I had one this week tell me. He said, "You know, I never heard my father tell me he loved me. you know, voice chokes up, tears in his eyes. Well, we want to hear from our Father, I love you. But we also want our Father to show that he loves us. And the way he does that is with time. In my world, I don't know what your world is like. I would bet that we would all say that we're busy. And some of us are extremely busy. I look at Chip out here, and Chip, I don't know, but a lot of your years, your world started about, your day started about 6 or 7 in the morning, it wound up about 6 or 8 at night. I mean, it's a long day. Chip's a surgeon, and they just have a long day. I have a long day on many days. And the thing that I struggle with is that if I don't schedule it, it doesn't happen because something else is happening. And I have to schedule, you know, at least a month out if I want to be able to protect a certain time block. And so, you know, they're just choices you make. And so if my daughter is a pom girl at her school, and I don't make all of her games, but any I make, it's because I put it on the schedule. It's kind of, hers are kind of difficult. They're at 3:30 in the afternoon and 4:30 and times like that. Made one this week. And believe me, they notice the choices we make. They notice the choices we make on vacations. You may say, well, I'm too busy to take a vacation. Well, when Kent and I started in business, we really struggled the first couple of years. In fact, we lost all of our business the first year and a half. And after about 2 years, we realized the only week I had taken off was the week for my honeymoon. And I think he'd had 1 week off in 2 years. And we decided that we're going to take vacations. We figured if you're making a lot of money, you can afford it and you need it. And if you're not making a whole lot of money, then it doesn't make much difference. Take off anyway. And so, but your kids notice the choices that you make. And believe me, your kids want you to spend time with them.
All right, the third point, it says, keep it simple. Now, I think being humans, we always try to complicate things. We think through it too much. We overanalyze. And, you know, one of the characteristics of God, while he's infinitely indescribable and infinitely incomprehensible at times, he's a simple God. You know, the characteristics of God are pure and good and simple. Following the example of God and the example of Christ in parenting, we need to try to just keep it simple. In the Old Testament, in Ephesians 20, God delivers all of the commandments for the human race in just 10 simple phrases to Moses. And that was still too difficult for mankind. And so Jesus simplified it even more in Matthew 22 when he boiled it down just to two commands. Love God, the Father, with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Well, in that same mindset in parenting, when I grew up in our house, we had the three D's. I knew that I would get a spanking if I was disobedient, if I was dishonest, or if I was disrespectful. And that worked. I mean, it worked, got my attention. In our home now, it's different for each kid. But in our home, we deal with four rules that my two-year-old could, 6 months ago, she could spout them off back to us. And it's no screaming, no whining, be happy, obey. And so, for her personality, the thing that we got to deal with was screaming, whining, a bad attitude, and disobedience. And so we said, all right, Emma. And I mean, this is when she had just turned 2 years old. We say there's four rules. You're going to get in trouble if you scream, whine, if you're disobedient, or if you've got a bad attitude. And so we just made it. No screaming, no whining, be happy, obey. And she can spout that back to us. She knows what the expectations are. It's not overcomplicated, and it's easy for her to understand. So it's easier for us to discipline.
Now, Grant, how would you describe your two children? Just give us an overview of them.
Emma is, like I say, she's almost three, and she is very bright.
Of course.
Advanced. Really strong-willed. We've got the Dobson book on strong-willed children by our bedside right now. Very dramatic, theatrical, expressive, lives in a fantasy land, loves Little Mermaid, and the dinner conversation is pretty interesting sometimes. Our son, Ford, now he's just turned one, and so his personality hasn't come to fruition as much as Emma's. But he is the bipolar opposite compared to Emma. He is determined to, you know, learn how to walk. He's got some delays and disabilities physically and in his hearing. And so he has some challenges ahead of him, but he's really pushing through that. But his temperament, and we could see this from when he was 3 months old, his temperament is just really content, just really sweet, wants to be held.
Kind of laid back.
Quiet personality, just real content. And so we've kind of got both ends of the spectrum there. There are some hard and fast rules in parenting, but for us, we're finding that a lot of them don't necessarily apply across the board. You've got to do different things for different kids.
And that brings us to the fourth point, and that is every child is unique. Here you have Emma, who's a sweet little girl, but she just kind of like got retro rockets going all the time. And Ford's just happy to be here. So, and in our family, three children, not as dramatically different as that, but you know, Grant was one of those. When he was a little kid, probably 2 years old, 3 years old, he was just fearless. It wasn't that he didn't have sense, it just wasn't very evident. And so Grant would, down at my dad's lake house, Grant, the beach out there is just a very gentle slope, and you can just walk out for a long time, it's just a very gentle slope. And so Grant was a little guy, and he'd just start walking out there, and the water would be up to here, and he'd keep walking out, and the water would be to here, and he'd keep walking up, and the water would get to here, and he'd keep walking, and the water would be here, and he'd still be walking out. And he just thought, no big deal. You know, my daughter Annie is very different than that. She's not near the risk taker that Grant is. You give Annie a bunch of Disney videos, she's just pleased to be here. In fact, I went up to her last night or the night before, and she was upstairs on the computer, had a video going on the TV, and she was just sitting there, you know. I said, Annie, we get kind of lonely for you downstairs. You know, but she's happy in her world up there. So every kid is different. Every child is unique. And so what we have to do as parents is to figure out how to adapt life's principles in parenting each child. And they'll be different. We struggle with trying to do the right thing for every different child, but not treat them all the same. Now, we don't want to show preference, but my second son, Blair, he continually is saying, well, you did such and such for Grant. He's ignoring the fact that Grant is how much older? 7 years older?
7 years.
Grant's 7 years older. And so he sees what we did with Grant, and he says, okay, apply that to me, but now. You know, when Grant got out of, I'm trying to remember when it was, Grant, when you got out of, no, when he turned 21, I bought him a really nice watch. And so Blair reminded me about that. But Blair is still not 21.
But he got the watch.
But he got the watch this Christmas. Hey, if I'd have waited until he was 21, it wouldn't have been a surprise. So I gave it to him at Christmas. You know, really, and there are times, I'll just say in Blair's mind, that watch means Dad loves me. And that watch means, you know, I'm a man now. Okay? And so at Christmas time, Blair doesn't turn 21 until May, but at Christmas time I bought the watch and gave it to him. It means a lot to him. So every child is unique. Yes, you try to not show preference, but you do treat every child differently according to, you know, the Bible says raise up a child in the way he should go, and that really means in the way he's bent. And children are bent in different ways. Everyone is unique. Psalm 139 talks about, getting back to this idea of how does God treat us. Psalm 139, the whole chapter is about how intimately God knows us. He saw us before he was born. He shaped us. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. And so God knows us intimately. But the way he knows me is different than the way he knows Grant, different than the way he knows Neil, different than the way he knows Chip, because we're different people. And so God will allow one thing to come into my life, and maybe the way that he treats Chip or the things he allows, what Chip needs, is entirely different than what I need. And so realize that every child is unique, and your parenting child has to be customized to each different child. Anything else on that, Grant? Number five is say no only when you have to. This gets tough. Because as parents, we want for our children to be independent. We want for them to mature. We want for them to make right decisions. But there are times when we may choose to let them go into something even though we know it may be harmful for them. And then there are other times when we say, no, that harm is too much to bear. You can see this in the Bible, Galatians 6, 7, 8. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever man sows, that he will also reap. We can't keep our children from sowing. They're going to sow some things. I know of a person that used to live in Oklahoma City, and they were very protective of their children. And then when their children got out of high school, they left home and went absolutely wild. So you can't keep your children from spreading out their wings a little bit. You can't keep your children from getting to the point where they make their own decisions. Again, how does God treat us? He gives us guidance. He tells us, if you do this, I'll bless you. If you do this, there's consequences. Then he lets us make our decision. But there are times when God doesn't even allow us full reign. You know, 1 Corinthians 10:13, that he will not allow a temptation to come our way that we're not able to bear. And so there's times when God says, no, can't go that far. I won't let this person be pushed that far. In our life, the way this has played out is, you know, when Grant got out of high school, he took a year and he went to
Operation
Mobilization. And he spent some time in Russia, right after Soviet Union had broken up. Spent about 9 months in South Africa. So we went down and saw him in South Africa in about Christmas time during that year. And we went up to Victoria Falls. It's the Zambezi River, and it's between I think South Africa and
Zambia and Zimbabwe.
Zambia and Zimbabwe. See, he was there for a year. He knows better. On the bridge by Victoria Falls that goes over the Zambezi River, at that time it was the highest commercial bungee jump in the world. And so they would tie this bungee cord on you, and you would dive off of the bridge, and there are crocodiles down in the river swimming around. And so Grant says, Dad, I want a bungee jump off of that. Can I do it? I said, you're 19 years old. You're halfway around the world. You're going to do it anyway. I'm not going to pay for it. And so we watched him as he bungee jumped off of that. I forget how tall it is. It's tall. How'd it feel?
It was great. About 463 feet.
Wow. How was it? Now, later on, after we were gone, he decided he'd go do it again. How was it the second time?
Just as fun.
He was more scared the second time.
Yeah, you're right. The first time I jumped off just quickly. The second time I thought about it a little bit before I took the plunge. So.
You know, Blair spent the summer in Europe. And so he decided he was going to go to Pamplona and run with the bulls. Again, people say, I can't believe you let him do that. Well, you know, how am I going to stop a 20-year-old kid who's not with me from doing what he wants to do? If I say, okay, son, you can't run with the bulls. If he wants to run with the bulls, he's going to go run with the bulls. But there are times when you say, no, we're not going to do that. Annie is 16 now. She just turned 16. Well, last year, there was a little guy at her school, and he was from a nice family. And can I go out with so-and-so? Well, we checked him out and talked to him, and sure enough, you can go out with so-and-so. Well, then it kind of evolved from there. And before we knew it, she was going out with a real so-and-so. And it was not a good thing. You know, she's a 15-year-old girl, and at least Annie at 15 was really not ready for all that was coming her way. And so we finally said, two things. One is, no dating till you're 16. And second, you're not going to date older guys. Well, she's 16 now, so she can date now. But she still cannot date older guys.
Amen.
That's an older guy right there. But so there are some times when, as a parent, you say, yes, child, you know, you have a lot of leeway, and I'm not going to say no to a whole lot of things. But there are some things you say no to because the risk is too great. The consequences would be something that they really can't bear. As it says in 1 Corinthians 10:13, God wouldn't let a temptation come our way that we're not able to bear. And so as parents, we need to use our judgment in what we allow our children to do, and then sometimes we have to say no. Ephesians 6:1 talks about children, obey your parents in the Lord, but it also goes on to talk about fathers, do not exasperate your children. And so there's a delicate balance there between teaching them to make the right decisions and then being too hard on them to where we're really driving them away from God and driving them into a life of disobedience.
All right, the sixth point that we've got here, it says, love, pray, and welcome home. You reach a point, I'm sure someday I will reach a point as a parent, where
already reached it as a child.
I've reached it from this end, but from the parent side, where you said no as much as you can, and you get to the point where you realize that it's beyond your control, and it just drives you to your knees, and you realize that there's nothing more that you can do than just to love the child, to earnestly pray for the child, and ask God to take it from you, and then at some point, pray that God would use whatever means to bring the child back to Himself, and you can welcome the child back home. When I was in high school, I was the model child up through, 16 years, first 16 years of my life. And then I was a Christian. I was raised in a Christian home. I accepted the Lord when I was 8. But I had never allowed Jesus Christ to take lordship of my life. And it's easy to be a, to live a good life that is in line with the Christian principles you've learned, until you reach a certain point and the temptation starts to roll in. And I just checked out.
And that's called the driver's license is the, the difference.
I reached a point where I just checked out. The latter part of my high school years, up until the point where I decided to seek after God and take a year off and go on to the mission field to follow after God, was the toughest time in my life, and probably the toughest time in Mom and Dad's life at that time. They reached a position, and I'll let Dad talk about it, how they came to that conclusion.
Before I do that, the biblical pattern for this is the story of the prodigal son. The father, when the son came to him and said, give me my inheritance, the father could have said, no, not going to. The father in the story of the prodigal son is a picture of who? It's a picture of God. It's a picture of the way God treats us. And the father said, okay. And so the son took it, and the son spent his inheritance in riotous living, wound up feeding the pigs and wishing he could eat what the pigs were eating. And he came to his senses and said, you know what? The servants in my father's house are better off than I am. I'm going to go be a servant in my father's house. The most beautiful part of the story is that when the son is still a far way off, the father's watching for him. If you're a dad, you understand that, don't you? The father's looking for him. Because the dad's been praying for that day, hoping his son would come back. And instead of the father saying, well, buddy, you're going to start at the bottom, the father threw a party for the son. The father welcomed him back with open arms, put the robe on him, let's kill the fatted calf, and let's throw a party, because my son is back. My son was away, and now he's back. We have come to the point in Grant's life, and I'll tell you about that. We've come to a point in Blair's life where we really could do nothing other than to let them know we loved them and pray for them. In Grant's situation, it really revolved around a dating relationship. Now, there were a lot of factors more than that, but Grant had a stretch in his life that he spoke of where he just wasn't walking with God. And he wasn't real happy. He was really kind of thrashing around and trying to figure things out. And you know what? I don't know if you've been there, but most of us have at some time in our life had a point where we're trying to sort out, who am I? Who is God? What does it all mean to me? And what am I going to do about it? And I really believe the most important thing we can do for our child at that stage in his life is to let them know that we love them and to pray for them. But really, you're not going to do a whole lot by browbeating them at that point. and your ability to put constraints on them is rather limited. And we'll talk about that. What happened in Grant's case is that he had a dating relationship. And when I talk about how we don't know as parents what to do, you kind of get into these deals and you're in it, and then you adjust and you think, I don't know what's right, and you ask counsel. And in that case, we had some concerns about this dating relationship. And so at first I said, I don't think you ought to be dating her. But you're 20 years old, you go ahead and do what you want. Grant got frustrated during this whole thing because we kind of kept changing. And he'll talk about that some, maybe. So we that's where we started off. You know, we don't like this, but you're 20 years old, go ahead. Then, one day this was 1995, right after the Oklahoma City bombing, I was at a men's meeting over at First Southern Baptist in Del City. And I don't know about you, but it's really hard for me to ask for help from somebody. It's hard for me to ask for counsel. And so I was over there, and Tom Eliff is the pastor there, and I saw him. I went up to him after the meeting. I said, can I ask your advice on something? And he said, sure. And so he and his wife, we went back into his study, and it's been about 45 minutes. And I told him the story about this relationship and our concerns and kind of where we were. And I made the statement. I said, well, you can't tell a 20-year-old kid who to date. And he said, oh, really, biblically, why do you say that? And I said, well, He said, well, it says here, it says, children, obey your parents. And then it says here, for this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. And, he's got the best of both worlds. He's not obeying you, and he hadn't left you, so you're still paying, and he's cleaving to her. And I said, I never looked at it that way. And then he shared with me five rules that he has for before he'll perform a marriage ceremony, a wedding ceremony. And he did this back in the mid-70s. He and some buddies were frustrated because they would counsel these couples, they would marry them, and then many of them wound up getting divorced. And so they said, what's going wrong? And they came up with these five rules. And in the 20 years or so at that time, since that, he had not had any couples where all five of these things were true, where the marriages had ended in divorce. Now, he'd had two couples where the couples misrepresented some things, and those had ended up in divorce. But the five rules are these. They're both believers. It's sometimes it's obvious to us whether a person is a believer or not. In the case of Grant and the girl, I honestly don't know whether she was a believer or not. She professed to be. But number one is they're both believers. Number two is they're both biblically free to marry. And this gets back to the question of what about divorce and remarriage and things of that nature. Tom's application of that was that if a person is divorced, if their former mate is not remarried, then they're not biblically free to marry, as long as that's a potentiality to heal that marriage. Third is, does the marriage have the enthusiastic encouragement of all parents? Now, you need to look at every word there. Enthusiastic encouragement of all parents. And in the situation with Grant and the girlfriend, either we were happy with it, and her parents weren't, or her parents were happy with it and we weren't. There just seemed to never be a time when everyone was happy with that relationship. And so we couldn't say that relationship had the enthusiastic encouragement of all parents. One time, Tom called off a wedding at the rehearsal dinner. A wedding of the daughter of a deacon in his church. Because he said to the mother, he says, well, I guess you're excited about this. And she goes, well, I don't know. I'm going to go along with it, but I've got some real questions. He said, you do? She goes, yeah, I do. He said, well, I'm not going to do the wedding then. That was at the rehearsal dinner. And, there were some folks pretty upset. Within 6 months, the young man and the young lady both had found someone else who they wound up marrying, other people, and they've come back to him many, many times saying, thank you so much. We were good friends, and everyone thought we ought to get married, but, we shouldn't be married. We were just kind of being swept along. So it has the enthusiastic encouragement of all parents. Next is that the groom is vocationally focused so that he will be able to be the sole supporter of his family. In other words, he knows where he's going, and where he's going will be something where the family can live on it when he gets there, if I can put it that way. In Grant's case, he was kind of at the stage of life where he was thrashing around. He didn't have a clue where he was going. And so he sure didn't need to be in a serious dating relationship. And then the last one was that the relationship brings out the best in both of them. Now, you've seen that. You've seen relationships where nice girl, nice guy, but it just seems that they can't get it to work right. And, you know, someone's always upset, or they don't look happy. So does it bring out the best in both? And in Grant's case, that was not true. They spent one semester both attending University of Oklahoma, and truth is, his grades were awful, and so were hers. And it just seemed like they were bad medicine for each other. So I come back to Grant, and I say, well, Grant, tell you what, if you're going to, you need to break up with her. And he goes, wait a minute, what's the deal? You all are changing this. I said, yes, we are. And she said, you're trying to control us. And I said, yes, we are. And so he broke up with her.
Well,
kind of. And then we found out that he hadn't quite broken up with her. And so then I said, well, if you continue to date this girl, then you need to know you're doing it without our blessing. That still didn't do it. And so finally we reached the point. And all this took about 3, 4, 5 months. We reached the point where we were driving driving home from Colorado on vacation. And I went back to this leave and cleave verse. And I said, okay, look, if you're going to date her, you need to leave. And leave means that you move out of the house and I don't pay for college. Now, I must put in a disclaimer. Tom Eliff told me to never do that. Okay? But that's what we did. And Grant said, well, tell you what, I'll break up with her, but I'm just doing it for the money.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that was my second response. First response was, fine, see you later. And then I came around to my senses and I said, all right, well, my heart was not in the right spot.
And so I said, something to the effect, well, that's why prostitutes do things, is for the money. And I said, I'll tell you what, if that's the way it's going to be.
It was a beautiful time in our family.
I said, if that's the way it's going to be, I mean, this was really intense.
This is at a motel in
Dalhart, Texas. Well, by this
in the parking lot.
Well, by the this took time took place over length of time. This last point was we were in the car and it was just the three of us. We had two cars on this trip, and it just happened that on this particular leg, Grant and Dana and I, Dana's my wife, were together in the car. When we got to this last point, I said, I'll tell you what. If you're going to keep dating her, why don't you just, when we get home, pick up your stuff, move out, stop by the office Monday, and I'll write a check and pay you off for your education. You can be gone.
But Dad said one thing that got my attention, and he said, consider this. He said, you're trying to make a choice here. And there is a right decision and there's a wrong decision to make. And we disagree. So either you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and you're wrong. If you're right and I'm wrong, and God's will is for you to be with this girl, then God's will come through, and at some point it can happen. But if I'm right and you're wrong, then you are stepping outside of the will of God and outside of the protection of God for the rest of your life. And it just made me kind of sit back and think, you know, God does have a sovereign plan for my life, specific for my life. And in all this stubbornness and bullheaded arguments that I'd had with Dad and trying to show my power and, you know, maturity. I was really just trying to show him that I had grown up. I hadn't consulted God and wondered what God had for me. And so that's what kind of broke me finally.
Well, and I when I said that, they pick up the check, he turns to my wife and he said, "Mom, how do you feel about this?" She goes, "I agree." He goes, "Well, I don't want that." He said, "I'll break up with her." And I don't know if it was right then, but he said to me, he said, "I'll do that, but I'll never say thank you for it." And he didn't until about 6 months later.
Yeah. And I sure hope this is helpful for somebody out here. Because right there, good. Because I would just as soon never think about that whole chapter of life again. But if it is beneficial for those who hear, good. That's encouraging.
Can I tell the rest of that story 6 months later?
Oh, I don't know what was 6 months later. I've tried to black this thing out.
Six months later, he comes home. He's still in college. He comes home, and he's going to a wedding out of the church, and he swung by this girl's house on the way back because he hadn't talked to her in 6 months. And when he pulls up, she is packing up her car because her parents have kicked her out of their house. And she's moving in with her rock and roll band player boyfriend. And her life had not gone well. And he came in, he was really shaken, and he said, "Dad, I told you I'd never say thank you for that, but thank you so much." And the rest of the story is that, Grant, did you meet Jennifer the next year?
No, I didn't meet Jen until 3.5 years later, 3 years later.
Okay.
We went to Baylor for 4 years together and never met. And 5 years ago, on February 27th, I met just the perfect girl that God had waiting for me the whole time. And when I met her, it was evident that that was the right thing. And it was a certainty and a surety that I had never felt before. And so I was thankful, you know, when I saw my ex-girlfriend in the shape that she was in, because I realized that that was more of her true personality or true nature, and she was kind of playing the part that she thought I wanted her to play while we were together. But I was unspeakably grateful when I met the right one 4 years later. And then my parents had the boldness and the just the firm, resolute spirit to stand in front of me and not let me get into something that could just ruin my life. So,
you know, we've had a thing with our second son, Blair. He wanted to pledge a fraternity. I've tried to pledge a fraternity when I was in college, and I went to see my dad, and he explained why I shouldn't. And it was good enough logic for me. I won't tell you exactly what he said, but he left no doubt in my mind. But Blair wanted to pledge a fraternity, and so we said, "Well, we don't like it, but you know, if that's what you want to do, go ahead." And he's now a sophomore. So he pledged his freshman year. He's now a sophomore. And, you know, I would just say this. Blair's at the stage right now where we've been letting him know we love him. We've been praying for him. And through a guy that's on campus, Cruise State staff at OU right now. I mean, I met the guy this week. Blair's been meeting with that guy once or twice a week. Blair is really, his heart is turning toward God. But it has not been that way for some time. But anyway, we reached the point last October where we said, "You're moving out of the fraternity house." And moved him into apartment for 2 months, last 2 months of last semester. He lived by himself, which is not what most college guys want to do, and several miles from campus. And then he has a roommate this semester. But I'm telling you, that kid, his countenance is changing. His everything is changing. And he told me about a week ago, he said, "Dad," he said, "You know, Dad, we might be able to compromise on this thing." He said, "I'm kind of coming more to your point of view." I said, "Well, I'm not really ready for compromise." You know, But the point is this. Parenting is a struggle. And there comes a time when you have to let your children know you love them. Even though you don't like what they're doing, you don't like some of the choices they're making, love them, let you know you love them, let them know you love them, let them know you're praying for them. But it really doesn't do a whole lot of good to preach at them and to beat on them and to condemn them. It doesn't do a whole lot of good to send them Bibles and put memory verses on their mirror and things like that, because they're not ready to hear about it. But if they know that you love them, regardless of their behavior, and if they know that you're praying for them, God will work on them, and God will get it into a message they can understand. You know, when Chip and I were at OU, we were the same year at OU, and through different circumstances, God showed us how to have a relationship with Jesus Christ and a walk with Jesus Christ in a contemporary language through peers that we could understand. And that's the way God did it with Grant at Baylor. That's the way he's doing it with Blair at OU. Well, our role changes as we get older. And suddenly, you know, Grant is no longer, first and foremost, my son. He is a husband and a father. And I'm still a husband and a father, but I'm also a granddad now. And I'm also a father-in-law now. And so it really kind of gets more complicated. But point number 7 is treat them like adults. I'm going to let Grant talk some about that.
You know, it's a difficult transition for everyone involved. It can be a wonderful transition to go from being a child in the home underneath the authority and guidance of parents to being an adult yourself. It's a wonderful transition, but it can also be a difficult transition for the parents to take the hands off and allow you to act and function as an adult. There's definitely a change and a transition in roles. And we spoke earlier of the verse in Ephesians 5 where it says, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife.
Genesis 2.
Well, it's in Ephesians. Genesis 2, and then it's repeated in Ephesians 5. Very seldom does he correct me, and he's not right. And so I'm going to kind of savor this moment here. Especially about the Bible.
You know, we're both in the real estate business. We both have finance degrees. We were driving down here, and he sent me a worksheet a couple of days ago, and he said, here's what you can do with these interest rates and whatnot. And so we're driving down here yesterday. We're not looking at a computer or the sheet or anything. I said, hey, you were wrong on that formula. You should have done such, 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 such. He goes, well, no, I mean, so here we are arguing some computer formula driving down the interstate.
He was right on that time. But, but the transition can be difficult. And I tell you, if it takes transition on both sides. You know, when I'm reading that verse and I say, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, I think, what does it mean to leave? You know, sometimes there's a geographic separation. I know when I told my in-laws that I wanted to move their baby, we were in Dallas, and they are from Mount Pleasant, which is about an hour east of Dallas, and had a job opportunity to move to Oklahoma City. They were not enthusiastically supporting our decision to move from Dallas to Oklahoma City because it's putting more miles between them and their baby. They came around and they support us now, but the geographic thing might be an issue. But in leaving, there's also the change of roles in the relationship. And I guess to look at it from a child standpoint and also from the parent standpoint, from the new adult or the young adult standpoint, a lot of times you hear teenagers saying, I want you to treat me like adult. And the parents say, if you want to be treated like adult, then act like an adult. Well, you find a lot of people who have maybe gotten out of college, they're in their early 20s, and they're still not acting like adults. And that is, it's wrong on the part of the child because they are enabling their parents to continue acting like parents. You know, God is called people to grow up and to become adults. Paul speaks of it many times, and And I think that from the young adult, they need to realize their position and their identity as an adult, which takes some time. On the parent's side, it is one thing to pull your hands off and allow them to make decisions and allow them to control their finances and be self-supportive. But then when grandkids come into the picture, it's an additional transition that is tough on some parents to go transition from parenting to being grandparents. And at times, grandparents will think that it's still their role to try to parent the grandchild. But what that is it's not encouraging and it's not loving to their children. And so, as a grandparent, when they can encourage the children to do it their way and realize that their days of parenting have concluded, you've only got 18 years, really. And then you've got to set them off on their way and hope that the training and the upbringing that you've given them is enough. I guess not to offer counsel continually, but offer counsel or guidance when asked for. So.
Yeah, my dad and mom had two rules for themselves. They didn't tell us the rules until many years later, but as we became adults and got married, my parents had two rules that they imposed on themselves. One is to come to our homes only when invited. Now, that may sound strange. And I can just tell you, I really believe if you put my dad in a car today and said, drive to Kirk's house, I don't think he could find it. Okay? And that's not because he doesn't have the ability to remember where he went. It's just that I've lived in that home for about 3 years, and he's been there about twice, two or three times, and we've invited him, and I have to tell him each time, okay, you come up, pen, and so on and so forth. Because he respects that we are a new family. You leave your mother and father and cleave to your wife, and so we are, in many ways, a separate family. And he respects that so much that he only comes to my home when we invite him. Now, for many, many years, we worked together. I mean, he officed when in the same building we did. And so it's not that we didn't see him. We saw him a lot. We ate lunch if he was in town and not playing around in Puerto Rico or somewhere, which is where he is today. We would eat lunch frequently together. But so it's not that we didn't have contact. It's just that that was something they believed showed respect for us. Second area that they imposed on themselves is to give advice only when we asked for it. That's probably tougher for me, as you can probably tell. But they've done that. I mean, I've been married for over 30 years. Now, the good thing is I've asked for advice from my dad a lot. A lot. But just imagine, he sold us a business and walked away and never gave advice except when we asked for it. Can you imagine that? And we lost all the business within 17 months. Never gave advice except when we asked for it. And so that's hard as now I'm a father-in-law and a father of a married son. You know, there are times when grandma wants to go see the grandkids. Oh, while we're down there, stop in. And sometimes we do. And Grant and Jen are nice about that. But there's times we say, no, honey, I mean, if we're going to see them, we ought to call ahead. You know, that kind of thing. So I can't say we rigidly adhere to the don't go by unless they invite you. But my parents do. They really do. But treat them like adults. They really are a new family. This comes really into a lot of comes into play when you're talking about how you raise children. Because probably by the stage of life I am, by the time you've been married 20, 25, 30 years, you and your wife kind of know what the rules are in your household as far as raising children. And so when grandkids come along, the natural tendency for us as parents is to try to raise and discipline our grandkids the same way we would do our own. But the only problem is we're not their parents. There's a tendency on the part of grandma and granddad to say, you know, don't do that to that child or don't let that child do that. Wrong. You're not their parent. Just kind of keep your mouth shut until you can get away from there. So treat them like adults. Second thing is understand your role. You know, Ephesians 6, 1 through 3 says this, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Okay? Children, obey. But really, verses 2 and 3 talk about a change in roles. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. So when we're children, we obey, but when we are not in the home anymore, we honor our parents. And it talks about a long life. So that to me, that says, after you're an adult, honor your parents and you'll live a long time. I don't think expecting us to live a long time as children. So children obey, and the adult child, honor your parents. And so we as parents of grown children and in-laws, our role is different than it was when they were younger. And it's more, I'm not so much now in the role of an authority in Grant's life, because I have no authority. Who's Grant's authority now? God. Grant's the authority in his home, he's answerable to God. He is not answerable to me. But if he wants to ask me something, then I'll tell him what I think. You know, this was a real interesting thing. Grant and Jennifer have a wonderful home, but they're kind of growing family, and so they decide they want to look at a different home. And so they looked for a different home, put it under contract, took us over there. Great, what do you think of the house? Am I going to say anything negative about that house?
Better not.
Because his wife thinks that's the most wonderful house in the world. But tell him the rest of the story, girl.
Well, and so Dad says, yeah, I like the house. It's a great house. We were approached about a week later with another buyer, from another buyer who wanted to pay us off to assume the contract. And this house that we thought was the one and only house in all of Oklahoma City that we could live in suddenly looked dispensable. And we thought, you know, just the fact that we're considering this maybe means that we ought to, maybe it's God offering us a way out of something that we maybe got into too quickly. And so we took him up on the deal and ended up transferring the contract. In talking to Dad about that, then we got to know that he did have a bit of uneasiness. And when I really examined my own heart, I thought, you know, I actually did too. And Jen said the same thing, but everyone thought, well, everyone else is for it. You know.
But, you know, the point is, after they put a house under contract is not the time to say, yeah, you know, I don't like this, this, and this. And truthfully, you know, houses aren't that big a deal. I mean, you know, no one's going to die, whether you buy the right house or the wrong house. It's a house. And it's sure not worth getting your daughter-in-law all upset at you because you criticize what she thinks the most wonderful house in the world. And it was a nice house.
Yeah.
But I had a few misgivings. But the only way I would ever tell him that is if he'd say, do you have any misgivings about this? And if he said that, then he's asked for the advice, and I'll let him know. But other than that, if it's, hey, come see the house, then we'll go see the house. So our role changes, and we need to understand our role. It's not an authority. It's more that of giving advice when asked. And then number 9 is, the goal should be that they have freedom with no strings attached. And when I say freedom, I really mean that they are mature on their own. You know, you look at the book of Ruth, and it's the story of how Ruth married, her husband died. She was with her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law, in the third chapter of Ruth, turned Ruth loose to pursue the best life for Ruth. Probably wasn't the best life for Naomi, the mother-in-law. But it was the best life for Ruth. And she said, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? And so Ruth got hooked up with Boaz, who was a relative of Naomi's. From that even came the line of King David and ultimately Jesus Christ. But the goal should be that we help them instead of hurt them. And many times parents try to help children and wind up hurting them. I'll give you a couple examples. Have you ever been in a home and you walk in and there's no furniture in the living room? Then you hear the story and it's, well, mom or dad helped us, they gave us the down payment for this, but the kids can't afford to buy furniture in the house. Are they helping them or hurting them? They're shackling them. They are making it easy for them to buy into a situation that's going to cause financial hardship on them and probably cause a lot of conflict in their marriage. I've been in homes like that. I've been in homes like that where the wife, literally there was no furniture in the living room. Her mother had given them the down payment for the house. And the wife told me that the night before she looked at a Coke bottle on the counter and thought about breaking it and killing her husband, but he was holding the baby and she's afraid she'd hurt the baby. And I believe that financial stress has something to do with that. John Crawford told me one time, we had had a preacher move into our church, and he'd been in a parsonage, so he had no down payment money. And so I gave him some money for a down payment. Another guy did, church loaned him some money. And Crawford came to me some months later, and he said, you know, you tried to help that young man, but you really hurt him. And I said, really, how? He said, well, when y'all gave him that money, he wound up buying that much more house than he could afford. He says, let me tell you how to help a young married couple. He says, my son Jay bought a house out in Yukon. And so Jay bought the house. Jay picked out the house. It's a house they can afford. And once they have that standard of living set, then I go out there and I kind of look it over. And I say, you know, they could use a new storm door on the back. And so I show up and I've got one of those glass storm doors, and I'm going to install that storm door. And I'm helping them because their house is better and it requires no payment out of them. It's no hardship on them. I'm helping them. And so there are ways as parents that we can help our children and not hinder them and really give them freedom with no strings attached. Most often in family relationships, the strings get attached when you're talking about money and you're talking about holidays. And I would just urge you as a parent of a young adult children, divorce yourselves from their finances. I mean, I honestly don't know what Grant lives on. I don't know how they spend their money. I've never had anything to do with that. Now, he and his wife work all that out. I had a whole lot to do with his finances when he was single, but I have nothing to do with him now because that's between him and his wife. I have the ability to have them live in the best neighborhood in Oklahoma City if I wanted to do that. That's not what would be best for them. And then when you get into holidays, you know, just remember, leave and cleave. And so, yes, they're a part of your family, but your family's not their primary responsibility now. Their family is their primary responsibility. I remember when we first got married, my wife, you know, it's not that parents aren't loving, it's maybe they're too loving. My wife's parents are both passed away now, but the first 4 weeks or 5 weeks we were married, every Sunday it would be, well, you want to drive up to Stroud, which is about an hour away, you want to drive up to Stroud for Sunday lunch. So after about, and it was great lunch, wonderful folks. After about 5 weeks of this, Grandma called on Saturday and said, hey, you kids want to drive up here for lunch on Sunday? And I said, no. I said, invite them down here. And so Danny said, well, why don't y'all come down here? And Grandma said, oh, Don works all week and he's tired on Sunday and he'd rather not drive. I said, well, I'm tired too. Now, we worked all that out, but the point is that when they get married, they're no longer first and foremost a part of your family. And we need to respect that. I just tell you, our daughter-in-law is from East Texas. We get to see her often. Probably at least once every week or two we see her. Dana keeps the grandkids once a week so she can get out a little bit. And so our deal with her parents on holidays is that whatever they want to do is just great. And I would really encourage you, I don't care where your kids live, you really ought to take that approach with your kids. Hey, whatever you work out is great. We'll adapt to that. I think families get in more fights over who goes where at Christmas and Thanksgiving and birthdays and all that than anything except for money. And it's just not worth it. You ought to bend over backwards to get along with the other side of the family. If they've given you a wonderful young lady or a wonderful young man, you ought just don't be a burden to them in that way. Give them freedom. Comments on that, Grant?
No, I just, speaking from the recipient of freedom, I just say that your children will thank you for it. There's no greater blessing than not having the guilt trip applied. You know, I know that with my parents and also with Jen's parents, that we can make our decisions and they'll respect our decisions as adults, and that it doesn't come with obligation. And that's just what love is. And when you think about, you know, going back to the first point of being kind of a portrayal of God's love, you know, God's love is patient and kind, and it is not it's not a burdensome experience to go through. Yeah.
You know, let me say one other thing on that. I have an airplane, and Grant just got his pilot's license and is working on his instrument rating. And here's the deal I have with Grant on flying the plane. The deal is that he can fly the plane if he'll put the fuel in it. But if he's flying his wife down to East Texas to see her mom, I'll buy the gas. And so, you know, there again, I'm helping him. That's a pretty good deal. I'm helping him, but I'm making the statement that I want him to take her to see her parents all he wants to. I don't want, you know, anything to be a hindrance on that. And so that's what we do with that.
The last point that we've got is thanks for the memories. Now, as parents, sometimes we get so caught up in the day-to-day busyness and the rush of life that we forget that our children are soaking in every moment of every day. My two-year-old has got a mind like a steel trap. We went and saw Monsters, Inc. when it came out a year ago. She had just turned 2 years old. And 4 weeks later, we're driving down the road, and she says one of the lines from the movie, word for word. We'd seen the movie once, a month later. They soak in things, and they retain those memories. And when I'm thinking of memories, Jennifer and I, we're intentional about the memories that we're creating in the minds of our children. And there's a difference. Sometimes you've got everyday memories. We live in a neighborhood that has got this beautiful park right in the middle of the neighborhood. And it's about a half mile to do a figure eight around the park. And so we make a point. Jen takes the kids walking almost daily. And I try to come back home at least a couple days a week, if not a few days a week, in time that we can still go for a walk in daylight and just spend some time talking. The kids are in the stroller. I've got our old English sheepdog on the leash, and Jen and I get a chance to talk. Well, I think for a kid, just one day, that seems like a big deal, you know, if that happened one day. But for a kid to experience that week after week, their whole time growing up, someday they're going to grow up and they're going to think back and they're going to have fond memories and saying, when I grew up, we used to go on walks and talk all the time. But what it takes is those commitments where you say, okay, I'm going to leave work at 5 instead of 6 today so I can catch some daylight and we can go for a walk. Another kind of memory that we are intentional about is more kind of the annual traditions. And the kind of families that are really interesting are the ones who have traditions that they've
been
doing. This
is kind of a Griswold deal here.
Oh, this is... When Jen and I got married, we realized that she had her family Christmas traditions, and I had mine, and they weren't the same. And at first, it was like...
Yours were right, really. I mean,
at first, she was so upset that we wouldn't open gifts on Christmas Eve, and I couldn't believe that anyone would try to open a gift before Christmas morning. Her family, they would give each other pajamas that you would wear Christmas Eve when you're opening gifts, and I'm not a fuzzy bunny kind of guy, and so we adapted. Well, now we've got a tradition that
now
when it
comes
time for Christmas...
Do yours have a trap door in them? Or
when it comes time for Christmas, we hop in the truck, we drive down to Norman, Oklahoma, we listen to Bing Crosby Christmas and Frank Sinatra Christmas, we cut down our own Christmas tree, we throw it back on the top, we drink hot chocolate, and we come home. And to be honest with you, decorating a Christmas tree is not my favorite thing to do. In our family, as a kid, you do it, and then as the kids enter adolescence, you know, shortly, year after year, my mom ended up carrying most of the burden of decorating the Christmas tree while we watched football or did something else. It turned into more of a chore. And so that's kind of how I saw it. But then when we got married, we said, let's make this a family tradition. We get the tree, we listen to the same music, we, you know, drink hot chocolate, and we decorate this thing listening to music. So it was fun the first year. The second year, it was more fun. The third year, you start to see the specialness of having a tradition. And, you know, over time, I think our kids will look back and they'll see things like that that we do throughout the year. We try to have, you know, something every few months where it's special. It's fond memories.
One thing we did in our family, I heard this from somebody, I thought it was a great idea. But we told the kids when they were very young, started telling them, hey, when you're 12 years old, you get to go on a trip anywhere you want to go for a week, just you and Dad. Now, in Annie's case, it became Annie and Mom and Dad. But when Grant probably 5-6 years before that started thinking, well, my 12-year-old trip, I want to go. You know, they had all these wild dreams of what they wanted to do.
It's been 3 days getting there, one day there, and 3 days coming back. I'm like,
but another way to let them know they're special. Now, maybe it's something that takes a lot of money, or maybe it's not. You can tailor it to meet your situation. But in our family, they looked forward to that, and they would change their mind. In Grant's case, he pretty early stuck on Hawaii, and so we went to Hawaii for a week. He caught a big marlin out in the ocean, and I about broke my back working over his back on that deal. I mean, the marlin was bigger than he was. But the reason we did it at 12, that's about the age when they're transitioning from a little kid into an adolescent, and you just really need to have that relationship between the father and the child, in as good a shape as you can get it, because heaven knows you're going to need all the help you can get as far as a strong relationship in those later years. And I would say with our kids, as we've had challenges with each of them, in every case, we've been able to get through those challenges because the relationships were in good shape going in. There was never any doubt with, oh, you don't love me, or oh, you're mean to me, or any of that. The relationships were strong, and they had to be strong in order to get us through the issues that we were dealing with. But, memories can work both ways. We say thanks for the memories, but for some of us, we can remember things that we don't give thanks for, because they're not good memories. They really are bad memories, and they haunt us. And we see this in Scripture. In Philippians 1, Paul says, I thank my God on every remembrance of you. So it's a very fond memory of his relationship with the people in Philippi. But later on in Philippians, he tells them, forget what's behind and strain forward to what's ahead. And there are some people that when they talk about their relationship with their parents, and particularly with their father, it's really something they want to forget about. So we need to realize that memories are very powerful, but they're very powerful for the good, and they're very powerful for evil. And we want to build good memories. So figure out what works for your situation and build some of those memories. Well, we could go on, but those are some principles to live by, principles to parent by. And it's interesting to see how those principles change and adapt as you go through different stages of life. And, Grant now is a husband and father of a young family. I'm a dad who's almost done as far as, the active years of parenting. We have about 2.5 years left with Annie before she gets out of high school. And then I figure most of the strokes we're going to put in, we put in. So, but the principles stay the same, and you adapt to them differently as you go along. I want to thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to respond. Yes. I get taken out of context all the time.
Okay. Yeah, the question was, we mentioned divorcing yourself from your children's finances.
I'm talking about your adult children there, okay? Married children.
What did you put in place to see that your children were safeguarded from financial stress and knew the biblical principles of financial management? Growing up,
I'm directed at Grant. What did you get?
Yeah, it's better to ask him what he got instead of what I intended to give
him. No, I never got it. Growing up, some parents have the mindset that the parent is a provider, can maintain all the control, and the kids come and ask for money whenever they need it, and the parent can dole it out. In our home, from a very early age, we had an idea that children should have some limited responsibility of their finances. And so when I was 4 years old, I'd get a nickel, or I guess a dime, for allowance. When I got 6 years old, it jumped up to a quarter. And from that early age, when they gave, every week they'd give me a 50 cents or whatever. And they'd give it to me in 4 dimes and 2 nickels. And when they would give it to me, I had a bank up in my room, and they taught me the principle of saving 10% and of tithing 10%. And that's why they gave it to me in 4 dimes and 2 nickels. And so from a real early age, I had that understanding that that was a good principle to have. I guess when I was in high school, Dad, you gave me the richest man in Babylon. Dad led by example. It was something that we talked about growing up. He also used books. If you are connected with my family at all through Kent, you get books. Dad also would use books to help, teach me principles and guidance. But it was something that we spoke of, and it was something that he assisted me with when I was young. You know, when I was 12 to 18 years old, I rarely tithed. It was not something that they enforced. It was something they allowed me to choose. And when I made the choice, it was my choice. And I did it, you know, with a grateful heart. But
you know, one thing that, Grant, you remember the summer you came home from college. You know, many colleges and universities sell students' names and addresses to credit card companies. And so I'll bet you on an average week we probably get 6 or 8 credit card things in the mail at our house. And so Grant came home from college one summer. And here's the point. You can parent as good as you can parent, and kids still have to kind of find their own way in the world.
This was after my sophomore year in school.
Tell them that story.
When I got to school, I got a credit card so I could get a free T-shirt or something.
Well, I made a mistake.
A free bumper sticker.
I made a mistake because I did this. Okay, you're going to be driving back and forth to Baylor. You can have a credit card, $500 limit. I'll co-sign it. But guess what happened after that?
Raise the limit.
Well, no, they sent him. Other people sent him credit cards, so he didn't need mine anymore. And so I was off the hook, and I didn't know where he was. And you know, he's got credit card city coming to him.
And my mindset from this is, I'm an adult. I'm grown up. I can handle it.
Life is wonderful.
I can handle it. And every month, I would do what I could to handle it. But being a full-time student, you didn't have, you know, 2 cents to rub together. And finally, after about 18 months, I had $2,500 or $3,000, which was just Mount Everest to me. I mean, it was a burden that I bore every month. And finally, I came to Dad and said, you know, I've kind of kept this to myself. I thought I could handle it. I need your help. And I hope that the kids, when they're in a similar situation, would do that. Sometimes they don't. And so sometimes I think it might be a situation where the parents can intervene. But still, that's a child in school, not like a family where they are the provider.
How did we handle it?
What Dad said, I mean, it was not judgmental at all, but he just said, I will pay it off for you, and you will pay me back with interest. And so he paid it off and cut off the credit card.
There was more. And if you get another credit card before you're out of college, I'm done.
Right.
With college.
And I didn't own another credit card until I got a small business credit card last year. And so that was a real blessing for me to get out of college debt-free. That's a good issue to bring up. I know people in college who would have credit card debts or gambling debts that they're never going to get out of. And so it's a big issue. But the parents need to help them out. But at some point, when they're the provider of the family, that's when you...
Yeah, back in the back. Can't. You know, his question is it valid for kids to provide for their own college? I think anything's valid in that regard. And I'll just tell you the truth, even with our kids, we have not followed the exact same financial principles with the three. I'll give you an example. Grant, the first time one penny of my money went into a car for him was when he graduated from college. So my two younger kids drive a little bit better cars than Grant did, and I'll tell you why. What we started doing with our kids when Grandma and Grandpa would give them $100 at Christmas, all this stuff, $5 for a birthday, our kids never knew you could spend that money. And so we always put it in savings accounts. And then about 10 years ago or something like that, I'm thinking, heck, they're paying 2% at the bank. Let's put it in the stock market. And the market did very well in part of the 90s. And so my younger kids, instead of, you know, having a few hundred dollars, they had thousands of dollars to buy a car when they turned 16, none of which they'd earned with the sweat of their brow. But it was just the accumulated gifts of a lifetime. And there may be some ways in which Grant thinks, hey, you're a heck of a lot easier on them than you were on me. You probably had that thought.
Well, but, I mean, it's different. It is different. But it's not something that I'm, because I'm thankful that I had to work to pay insurance and gas money and pay for the car. And so it's not something that I'm regretful or resentful of.
But to address Kent's question, you know, it's not our responsibility as parents to provide a college education for our children. It's not our responsibility to put gasoline in their car. It's not our responsibility to pay them an allowance. I think it is our responsibility to do our best to train them how to handle money and to be responsible with money and to be grateful for what they have. And that's going to apply different ways in different families and in different ways at different times in the same family. So I do think that whatever you are going to do with your children, they ought to know that pretty early. You know, maybe you say, hey, I'll pay for the community college, but I won't pay for Princeton, whatever. Yeah.
You were given your dad's 3 rules for his married children?
2 rules.
Okay.
There was only 2. I may have said 3. It's 2. Yeah. They'll only come to our home when we ask and we invite them, and they'll only give us advice when we ask. Chris?
Okay. On your love, pray, and welcome home.
Yeah.
And your example that you used with Grant was when he was in college.
Yeah.
Now, how would you handle that when they're in high school? Because, I mean, you can't say to your 15-year-old,
I think the principles there are that as parents, we cannot allow our children at any age when they're under our authority to be exposed to danger that is too much for them to handle. But within that constraint, I think that what we need is progressive discipline. Now, quite frankly, my inclination is to fire all my guns at once. I mean, I won't go into details, but I'll just tell you this thing with Blair this last year. One night we were sitting there at a restaurant in Norman, and I said, I can't believe we were kind of negotiating the rules. I said, I can't believe I'm having this conversation. But what we don't want to do is to make it to where we've done everything we can possibly do to discipline or limit the child, and then we have nothing, you know, we have no more cards to play. And so I think we need to have some kind of progressivity about it. I've just never reached to the point with a high school student where they rebelled to the point that they would not take what we said. But, you know, I think that you need, it says, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. I think part of that is to, I mean, I'll sit down with them and say, what would you do? Because they'll go, I don't think that's fair. Okay, what would you do if you were me? And your child did this and this and this. What would you do? Well, I don't know. But I think that gets back to that relationship. But no, you can't kick a kid out of your house, I don't think, when he's a junior in high school. There might be some circumstances where you would, but I certainly never got there. You know, you start disciplining a child when he's a few months old, and they understand what no means. And, you know, Jim Kennedy told me when we had young kids, you know, you discipline after the first disobedience, not the third. You know, you can train your kids to where they think you got to yell and scream before you mean it. And so, and with our kids, our rules were, you know, dishonesty, disrespect, disobedience, and if you break that, then you get a lick with a spoon. And I'll tell you real quickly, Grant, when he was a year and a half old, we were in Colorado with the Purifoys skiing, and Dana said, Grant, come here, and I knew he heard her. And you could kind of tell he just acted like he didn't hear her. He was ignoring her. And so I picked him up. We went in this little bedroom, and I said, your mama told you to come here, and you didn't come here. So I'm going to give you a spanking. So I gave him one lick. And I'd set him on the floor, and I'd say, okay, now come here. Okay, son, I'm going to have to give you one more lick. And I can't remember. I think it was
21, I think. I don't remember. I've heard. Paul?
I don't know. I heard a lot.
My point is this. We're not trying to punish them. We're trying to break their will, not their spirit. And finally, after 20 or so of these licks, Grant, little bitty kid, with tears, and kind of not wanting to do it, but he took those steps forward and came to me. And I'm telling you, from that day to this, this kid has always understood what it means to obey. Now, there were times when he would, you know, look you in the eye and say, I'm not going to do that. It's the story I told a while ago. But there needs to be a progressivity about it. But you don't want to just, I don't see it in Scripture. Fathers get mad at your children and beat the fool out of them at all. Yeah. Well, the way you keep them from that, you hear the question, how do you keep your children from expecting you to bail them out, is don't. You know, in our family, My wife and I even keep our finances separate. Now, it's our money, but she has certain things that she's supposed to run, and she gets so much a month to do it. And when the money's gone, the money's gone. You know, party's over. Same way with Blair's in college now. He has so much a month that he can have. And that becomes his problem. The only reason that I paid off those credit cards is I wanted that credit card to go away. But it was, you know, I'll pay that off, but you're going to pay me $100 a month with interest, and you're not going to have another credit card. What are we trying to do? We're trying to teach our child how to handle money, and we're trying to teach them that credit cards are very, very dangerous. And a whole lot of people can't handle a credit card and shouldn't have one. Now, if you can use it properly, then maybe it's helpful. But if you can't, then you shouldn't have one. That's the point. But no, I would not bail them out continually. I'm mayor of Oklahoma City. Blair, what precipitated his move out of the fraternity house was he got arrested in Norman. Spent the night in jail. Went to court. Was found guilty. I never talked to anyone in Cleveland County. I didn't go to the trial. I didn't hire an attorney. I didn't bail him out of jail. Yep.
At what age did you stop thinking of this?
Who said he stopped?
Well, you know, truthfully, it kind of varies on the child. But somewhere around the junior high age, I think, you know, they just get to be a lot less. And honestly, our daughter Annie, younger than that, I can't remember. But, you know, we don't have kids just storming off and being defiant and going to the room. We don't have that kind of behavior. There comes a time when discipline becomes less physical and there are other ways to discipline a child. We caught Annie in a lie last week. This was really funny. It's probably your nephew. We have a rule, no boys at the house if we're not there. And so we got home and there was a ring on the couch. I'm talking about a piece of jewelry, kind of down in the between the cushions on the couch, and I pick it up and go, "What's this?" And Dana brings her down, and she lied. And then Dana goes back to her, "Annie, that doesn't make sense. Come on." And so she told her the truth. A couple of guys came by and one of them took his ring off or whatever. Ring slipped off. And so we said, "Okay, you're grounded." Dana said, "You're grounded for 3 days." And she comes to me, she goes, "You think that's all right?" And I said, "Man, I think that's pretty light." if it's for a weekend, but, So, honestly, the high school guy, would he rather take one lick or be grounded for a weekend? He'd take the lick, you know, but you're going to change his behavior. What you do is you take away from something they want. I think our time is up. I'll be happy to stay here and answer questions, but you need to be free to go. So let me say a prayer for us, then we'll be up here to answer your questions. Father, thank you that you're the picture of what a father ought to be. And God, I pray that we can show to our families, to our wives, and to our children a picture of you. And God, I pray you'd give us patience, you'd help us to be loving, you'd give us wisdom. And Lord, we acknowledge that one of the toughest things in life is to be a dad and know what's right to do, when to do something and when not to. And so, God, we just ask for your wisdom, we ask for your grace, we ask for your guidance, we ask for your power. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.